Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again this morning. We were here last night looking at the rather fascinating topic of dinosaurs. We're carrying on with the geological theme this morning as we go into the evidence for Noah's flood. Little bit of a backstory. When I was growing up and I was attending creation lectures and conferences and so on and so forth, well, you'd go and sit and you'd listen to a presentation on the evidence for Noah's flood, and they'd take you to far-flung places like the Grand Canyon or Mount St. Helens and stuff like that, all places which I'd never been to and didn't think I ever would get to go to. I've been very privileged in the last few years to be able to travel and actually see some of these things. But it did get me thinking. I wonder if there's any evidence for a global flood on our doorstep here in the United Kingdom. And so part of what we're going to be doing today is not just looking at evidence of Noah's flood, but we're going to be looking at evidence for Noah's flood as locally as we can. Now, of course, there is one problem. You see, the Bible describes the global flood of Noah's day as being, well, just that, global. So we are going to have to go a little bit further afield occasionally to get a big perspective, but we're going to try and use as many different examples as we can from the local area, from the United Kingdom. Just a little reminder, creationresearch.net, you can find out lots of resources about what we do and where we go out the back. There's some free stuff to help yourself to as well, including our newsletters. And if you like these kind of topics, I'd encourage you to check out our Creation Research TV channel. It goes out online 24/7 around the clock. Plenty of content on there. And it's not just the science stuff. It's not just the geology and the rocks and the fossils. We also ask big, tough, complicated questions like, what is a woman? Now, that might not be seen as a big, difficult, complicated question, but in today's age, you do need to know answers to these questions as Christians, both from science and the Bible. Well, we actually have a medical biologist on our team who answered this question, and the great thing about Dr. Diane Eager is that she doesn't just identify as a woman, she actually happens to be one, and so she gave us her perspective from both science and the Bible, and you'll find a whole host of resources available to you on our websites. Okay, our main topic for today, evidence for the global flood, specifically seen in the United Kingdom. We are going to try and get a biblical perspective on geology as well as we go on through. So to start off with a biblical perspective, just like we did last night, we're going to start with Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created. And we get to the end of Genesis chapter 1, and the world that God created was very good. Genesis chapter 1, verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Very good, as we mentioned last night, Genesis chapter 1, verse 29 and 30, tells us that the animals only ate plants. There were no meat eaters in the very good world that God created. And in fact, by the time we get to Genesis chapter 2, we read that Adam and Eve are put in a garden and they have no clothes on. But they didn't freeze to death at night and they didn't get sunburnt cancer in the day. And so the world that God created was very good, and that includes the climate. Of course, by the time we get to Genesis chapter 3, man has now sinned. God curses the ground, death has entered the world, and the world has gone from good to bad. And then by the time we get to Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9, we read that God says, I will bring a flood to destroy all living things under heaven that have the breath of life. Why? Because mankind's thoughts and intents of their heart was only evil continually. The world had gone from good to bad to worse. So God said, I'm going to bring a flood to destroy all living things under heaven, and only Noah and those on the ark actually survived. The world had changed from good to bad to worse. And one of the questions we often get asked in creation research was, well, how big was this flood? How big was this flood of Noah's day? Well, the Bible does answer this. Genesis chapter 7, verse 19. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole of heaven were covered. Okay, I mentioned a Bible verse last night, Psalm 119, verse 160. God's word is true from the very beginning. And I mentioned that I believe that verse. And I also told you that because I believe that verse, that puts me at odds with most of my geological colleagues in the Geological Society. Because you see, what that means is that I believe that God did create the world as he said he did, in 6 days, a few thousand years ago, and then approximately 1400 years after creating the world, he destroyed the whole world in a flood. And the Bible says that the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and the whole of the earth under the heaven was covered. So if this is true, if God's word really is true from the very beginning, what kind of evidence would we expect to find? Now that's a question which very few geologists have actually asked. It's a question that when I get challenged by my colleagues, I say, well, what evidence would you expect to find if God's word is true? Well, they don't have an answer for that. So let's have a look at some evidence. What would we expect to find if there really was a global flood at some point in Earth's history? Well, let's take you down to the famous Jurassic Coast. We briefly went there last night to look at some of the dinosaurs, but we're looking at something different now. You see, along this stretch of Dorset, there's the Jurassic Coast, the famous Jurassic Coast, and every couple of years, we hold a convention. 4 days going down on the beach, digging up fossils, seminars and workshops in the afternoon and evening. We're actually holding our next one next year on the Isle of Wight. This was a couple of years back in 2022, when we held our first convention down to the Jurassic Coast. And here's Dr. Diane Eager, one of our researchers. And Dr. Diane Eager is looking very pleased with herself because she's found a fossil. Can you see the long brown thing in the middle there? That's fossil wood. It's fossil timber. In fact, the timber is so well preserved, we actually know what kind of tree it came from. It came from a southern conifer tree, or the Araucarias. In this country, we tend to call them monkey puzzle trees. Now, we know what kind of a tree it is for one simple reason. We still have those trees alive today. Now, these rocks are supposed to be nearly 200 million years old. And yet the fossils inside are still alive today. In other words, the trees haven't evolved. They haven't changed. What they have done is reproduce after their own kind. But then you shouldn't be surprised. Twice in Genesis chapter 1, God told all the trees and all the plants to reproduce after their own kind. In fact, 10 times he told all living creatures to reproduce after their own kind, just in one chapter. So don't be surprised when the evidence actually supports God's word. Oh, by the way, there's another fossil there. Can you see the curly-whirly ammonite? The curly-whirly ammonite is a deep-sea creature. The tree is a land plant. And when you have things like deep-sea creatures and land plants buried together, you're starting to look for very good evidence of a flood. Well, what is a flood? Well, a flood is water where water shouldn't be. I used this example last night. If you've got a flood in your bathroom, the water is on the floor, and it shouldn't be on the floor. It should be in the bath or the sink or the toilet. So if you're looking for evidence of a flood, you're looking for evidence of water where water shouldn't be. Water is not usually, well, certainly not volumes of water where deep sea creatures live, are not usually in the same place as land plants. And so if you find these two things brought together, you're looking at good evidence of a flood. By the way, this isn't a small flood either, because these rocks which show the evidence of a flood are pretty big indeed. In fact, you can actually trace these rocks all the way up throughout the United Kingdom. And when I start talking about things like evidence for a flood, lots of people begin to get quite skeptical. I mean, we've been told that rock layers take hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years to form. I mean, if you have ever been to the along the south coast all the way over to the White Cliffs of Dover, they'll tell you that the chalk accumulates at about a rate of 1 inch per thousand years, or 2.5 centimeters per thousand years. Now that's a pretty slow rate of deposition. And we're drilled into us over and over again that it takes long periods of time to produce rocks like limestone and so on and so forth. Well, we can actually see real life examples, by the way, where this simply isn't the case. Let's take you to Harper Hill near Buxton in the Peak District. Some great research that we first came across a number of years ago. Can you see all the white stuff? That white stuff in the valley there, which is slowly filling the valley up, is actually limestone. And we first came across this, it was our founding director, John Mackay, who came across this a number of years ago. You can see him here standing next to a fence. Now, limestone and chalk deposits are supposed to take hundreds of thousands of years to slowly build up at about a rate of 1 inch per 1,000 years. Now, have a look at this deposit here. Is there anything about this deposit that tells you how old it is? How long did it take to actually form all this white stuff? Is there anything about it that you can spot? I mean, how long do you think? Can you see the fence posts? Can you see the fencing material that this white stuff has come over and engulfed? And in fact, now we can actually put an absolute date on it, because material like this and fencing like this wasn't produced until after World War II. And so it's only 80 years or so at the absolute oldest. In fact, can you see where the fence post begins to go down into the rock? Well, we actually dug this fence post out, and the fence post at the top is wood, it's rotting, but by the time you get down to the bottom, it's turned to stone. It's petrified. Now, that tells you something very, very important. Fossilization, and indeed rock formation, has got nothing to do with time, but everything to do with the right process. What's the right process? Well, it's got something to do with the industrial park sitting at the top of the hill. Can you see where the white deposit is? It's filling up the valley pretty quickly. But that at the top there, there's not only a university park, but there's also a sewage works. Now, creation research for a very long time has said that limestone formation and production, whether it's the stalactites or the stalagmites or chalk or limestone, has got something to do with microbial activity. In fact, we can actually produce stalactites at an enormously fast rate of several centimetres a month if you put the right conditions in place. And part of those conditions, is the presence of bacteria. So it does seem like all the extra bacterial stuff from the sewage works seems to be accelerating this formation of limestone, and we've been following this for many years, and it's growing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. In fact, it's not just forming these layers, it's also starting to form fossils, where the lime begins to cover up leaves that have fallen into the rock. Now, in this case, it's just got a little covering on it. But by the time you get down to where it's solidly in the rock layers, the leaves themselves have actually turned into fossils. Now we've got fossils that are forming very quickly indeed. And again, it's a really important thing to try and recognize that both fossilization and rock formation has got nothing to do with time, but everything to do with a process. But what process are we actually talking about? Are we talking about the kind of process that you read in your textbooks? Like, for instance, the chalk that's supposed to take vast periods of time to slowly build up. Well, let's go to another location in the UK and put this to the test. Hunstanton Cliffs, famous for its geology. I grew up not too far away from there. I've been over to Hunstanton many times. Can you see the brown layer at the bottom? You see the red layer in the middle? You see the white layer along the top? Beautiful layers of cliffs. Well, here's the geology. At the bottom, you have the carstone. The carstone is a type of sandstone. It's very similar to the greenstone that you get along the south coast of the UK. In the middle, you have the Hunstanton Formation. It's a type of red chalk. It's not quite unique to Hunstanton, but it's basically named after Hunstanton because that's where it's found the most. It's a chalk that is full of iron. It's gone rusty. It's some rusty rock. And then at the top, you have the Ferriby chalk formation, or the white chalk, similar to the kind of stuff you find at the White Cliffs of Dover. Okay, there's your geology, and there's the supposed dates. At the bottom, at the Karstone, you have a supposed age of 109 million years. The red chalk in the middle is supposed to be 101 million years, and the Ferriby chalk at the top is supposed to be 99 million years old. Now, I don't agree with these dates, but just bear with me for a moment, because what we're going to try and do is put these dates to the test. But before we do, let's have a look and see what kind of stuff do you find in Hunstanton. Well, I've been there for many, many times. I've led multiple field trips there. Beautiful place to go and find fossils. And you find big fossils like this giant ammonite. Buried, smushed into it, a shark's tooth. Buried right next to it, a sea urchin that is turned up on its side. And in fact, on the day that we found this ammonite, we even picked up a sea urchin from the beach, a modern day one, and put it next to the fossil one. How old was the Ferriby chalk formation supposed to be? 99 million years old, almost 100 million years old. And yet these creatures haven't changed. They haven't evolved. 100 supposed million years and sea urchins have turned into sea urchins. They haven't evolved one bit. So there's really no evidence for the millions of years in the first place. You also find things like brachiopods. Brachiopods are also living fossils. We still have them alive today. There's the diagram on the left there, and you've got the modern day ones on the right. Can you see that little diagram there? See that little foot that comes out? It's a little foot that comes out and anchors itself to the bottom of the rock. And so it sits upright with that little foot coming out, anchoring it to the rock. Do you know how we find all of these fossil brachiopods in the rocks? They all look like this. Can you see with a little hole where the little foot would come out? In other words, these brachiopods are sitting upside down. Now, the standard story you're told is that these creatures were living, they died, and they got buried as they were living. In fact, we're often told that the fossil record is a record of life on Earth. But I'm sorry, it doesn't matter whether you're an ardent atheist who hates God or the strongest committed Christian and young earth creationist, both of you will agree 100% on one simple fact. All of these fossils are dead. They're no longer alive. You see, the fossil record is much less of a record of life on Earth and much more a record of death. How these creatures died and got buried. And the fact that you find these creatures tipped upside down, ripped up and shredded up, and many of the elongated fossils, the long fossils, are all pointing in the same direction, all indicates that these creatures were buried in flowing water. In fact, it's not just that, it's also the layers as well. If you look to the right-hand side of this fossil, you can actually start to see some of the rock layers showing up in the formation itself. In fact, this little fossil is sitting up through many of these layers. We'll come on to that in just a little bit. We've got some more examples of what we call polystrate fossils, fossils that cut up through many, many layers of rock. Okay, so we find big ammonites, we find shark teeth, we find lots and lots of shells, and we find things like brachiopods. Let's do some testing. I mean, the Bible says in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast to what is good. Let's do some testing to these dates. And to do so, we need to do a little bit of mathematics. So brace yourselves. I know we're not necessarily used to doing maths on a church service morning, but let's do some maths and see if we can test this. Okay, what are we doing? 109 million years. Oh, that's the age on the bottom, right? 99 million years, that's the age on the top. And if we take 99 off of 109, we're left with 10. 10 million years. In other words, according to the dates, it took 10 million years to lay down all these rock layers. Are we all following so far? Good. 10 million years worth of sediment represented in these rock layers according to the dates themselves. Well, how much rock layer is there? Well, the answer is about 20 meters or 65 feet. Now, you can go and check it out yourself, you can measure it yourself, or you can go and check the British Geological Survey and get the figures for your own. 20 metres or 65 feet worth of sediment. And it took 10 million years, according to the dates, to lay down 20 metres of sediment. 10 million years to lay down 20 metres of sediment. Now we need to work out how much sediment was being deposited every single year. Because you see, chalk formation is supposed to be not only a slow process, but a gradual, a consistent, a regular deposition. There's multiple papers that refer to it as being such. In other words, if it's steady and slow and gradual, and we know it took 10 million years, according to the dates, to lay down 20 meters of sediment, we need to do a simple division calculation. So what we're going to do, we're going to take the 20 meters, and we're going to express them as millimeters. So 20 meters is 20,000 millimeters. Now, at this point, we've lost most of the Americans in the audience, and it takes a lot to try and get it through. But hopefully, most of you are familiar with the metric system. 20,000 millimeters is the same as 20 meters. So 20,000 millimeters took 10 million years to be laid down. And if you do that calculation, 20,000 divided by 10 million, you end up with 0.002 millimeters per year. Or what is that? 0.0007 inches per year. Now, can we all put our fingers 0.002 millimeters together, please? It's quite difficult to do, isn't it? It's a teeny, 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 tiny amount. Okay, follow the logic through then, folks, because if 0.002 millimeters was being laid down each year, how long would it take to bury one of these 5-centimeter long vertical fossils? Well, at that rate, you're looking at about 14,000 years for an inch, or 28,000 years just to bury the brachiopod. Question, if you put a fossil shell out there, or not even a fossil shell, if you put a normal shell out there and wait for 28,000 years for it to be buried, how much shell have you got at the end? Not a lot at all. You see, don't be surprised then, by the way, that Professor Derek Ager from Swansea University made this point that the dates simply don't work. Now, he wasn't a Christian or a creationist. In fact, he hated creationists using his work, but he recognized the problems that evolution and millions of years produce. He said, if one attempts to calculate the rates of sedimentation, that's what we've just done, right? A calculated the rate that this material is being laid down. If one attempts to calculate the rate of sedimentation in the past, the results are usually ludicrous. 0.002 a year really is a ludicrous date. In fact, again, it's not about time, it's about a process. In fact, some people have then turned around and said, well, okay, maybe the chalk wouldn't have been constant. Maybe it wouldn't have been steady. Maybe there was a big burst and it got laid down really quickly and then it sat there for millions of years before the next burst came and laid it down really quickly. Well, there's an easy way of being able to actually answer this. We've got to ask the question, what does the evidence indicate about how these layers were laid down? Well, at Hunt Stanton, we have fossils buried rapidly all throughout the deposit, and we have now strong evidence of water currents and flowing water. How? Well, as part of my undergraduate degree in geology, we published a paper titled The Evidence of Transportation and Rapid Burial at the Fossils of Hunt Stanton. Transportation, by the way, means these fossils, these creatures didn't live there, die there and get buried. They were washed into place by flowing water. It was a 3-month project into Hunt Stanton, and what we found was that 93% of fossils showed evidence of having been washed into position. Therefore, these fossils were formed in water flowing in one direction, having been caught up in a big slurry of sediment before being rapidly buried and fossilized. Evidence, by the way, like this. You see all of the fossils, the little squid fossils, the pointy ones, all pointing in the same direction? All good evidence of flowing water, water that has washed these into position. And you can find this evidence all the way from the bottom to top of Hunt Stanton Cliffs and all the way along. There's no evidence that it was slowly and gradually buried, but that it was quickly buried in flowing water. Again, not time, but process. And remember, you can do this kind of calculation across the planet. Doesn't matter where you are, you get the age at the top, the age at the bottom, work out according to the ages how long it supposedly took to lay down, work out how thick the deposit is, and you will find the results that you get are ludicrous. They simply do not work. And generally speaking, these kinds of things are ignored by geologists. Well, what about really good evidence that these rock layers not only didn't take millions of years, is there any good evidence that they actually happened really, really quickly? Well, that's where we're going to begin to finish up on. Edinburgh Botanic Gardens, one famous fossil tree, now on display in the gardens. Not, by the way, found at Edinburgh Botanic Gardens, but found a few miles over to the west at Craiglith Quarry. There, by the way, is the diagram of how the tree was originally found in the 1800s. Can you see the rock layers? Can you see the tree? Can you see how the tree is cutting up, it's passing up through many, many layers of rock? In fact, this is what we call a polystrate tree. Poly means many, as in polytheistic, many gods. Strate refers to strata, which are your layers. This is a many-layered tree. In other words, it's a tree that cuts up through many layers. In fact, here's another fossil tree from Tennessee in the USA. Can you see the tree there? Can you see the layers? Can you see how the tree passes up through many, many layers of rock? There's the strata. There's the polystrate tree. Lots of evidence, by the way, that this tree did not live there, die there, and get buried there. Because this tree has got no roots. This tree has got no branches. This tree is just a trunk. And this tree is cutting up through many, many layers of rock, which are supposed to take many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years to form. Now, here I am in Tennessee with two ex-US Marines. Now, it's handy having a couple of ex-US Marines in the wild of Tennessee because we were going to track down some of these trees. And out in the wilds of Tennessee, you have things like bears, and you have things like elk, and you have things like hillbillies. So it's always good to have a couple of US Marines with big guns to come out and give you a hand. In fact, this area is very well known for growing drugs and all sorts of stuff, so you don't want to accidentally wander onto somebody else's property. But we did go and we traced down, we got a bunch of instructions from one of the previous researchers who'd been out there, which included instructions like, if you see a tree with a cross on it, you've gone too far, go back, and try not to die. That was another instruction. So we eventually did find the trees. There they are. Some spectacular polystrate trees. Oh, they're definitely great big trees, and they're definitely polystrate. You see all the layers? You see the tree that's cutting up through all the layers? So what are these trees, and what do they tell us? Because in fact, here, we found over 50 of them in this one deposit in the middle of Tennessee. Well, let's bring it back a little bit closer to home for the moment. Geology of the Manchester area by Eager and Broadhurst. And on the back of this book, it's now out of print, you can occasionally get it on eBay and the like, but on the back of this book, you've got a picture of a fossil tree, a polystrate tree. Well, it used to be the part of the geology trail. You'd go up through Jumbles National Park, up in between Manchester and Bolton, and you'd go up through the trail, and there was a big path and a big viewing platform where you could go. Well, all of that has disappeared. It's all been overgrown. They've shut it down. It's still public land, though, so with the right knowledge, i.e. the book, you can track it down a little bit. And we did. And it's still there. It's a little bit worse for wear, a little bit more worn, but it's still definitely there. Dig it out, clean it up, take one of our young interns along so he can do all the hard work, because, you know, what are interns for? And you get your photograph taken next to it. Pretty spectacular fossil tree. But what's really interesting is what the book says about this tree. Because the book says this tree was apparently overwhelmed by flooding. In other words, it's a flood deposit. Oh, and by the way, these are not trees as we often think about today. They were huge, great big structures with big trunks and branches at the top, but they were basically belonged to the club moss family. Now, today, club mosses sprawl out on the floor along, you know, in Wales, and they're tiny little things. In the past, they were huge, enormous trees, but they are hollow. They have a great big thick bit of bark and body structure, but the inside of them is actually hollow. Now that's important for this next bit, because you can see where the bark, where the structure of the tree has turned to coal. But if you trace this tree right down to the bottom, what you can actually see is there's another tree underneath it. This is a tree where two trees have ended up being smashed into each other and have been buried upright vertically through all the rock layers. Now you know for sure that this tree didn't live there, die there and get buried there, because trees don't grow on top of each other. Here we have an example of something that is definitely a flood deposit. And it's fast evidence for sure, because all of the rock layers that are burying this tree had to be buried at the same time that this tree was being buried. You couldn't have had it slowly build up around the tree, because what would happen to a hollow tree? It would be crushed. The fact that you've got this tree here with the inside having been filled up from the sediments at the top, it all has to be buried at exactly the same time, otherwise you simply don't get a fossil tree at all. But how did we get a tree with no roots, with no branches, smashed up on top of another tree, actually buried? Well, the standard story with these fossil trees, because they're all coming out of the coal, right? And coal and these fossil trees are supposed to have formed in a swamp. Well, we can go to a swamp, a modern day swamp, and we can ask some questions. Starting with, where is the water level normally at this swamp? Is there anything on this picture that tells you? Can you see the base of the trees? Ah, that's where the water level is normally. Because if you get up nice and close to the swamp, you can actually see the difference there from top to bottom? You see that sort of darker patch of the tree? This, by the way, is called differential rotting, or differential weathering, where the water rises and falls, it begins to rot the base of the tree. Okay, if this swamp was buried and turned into a fossil deposit, what would it show? Well, it would show evidence of soil, because these trees are growing in something. It would show evidence of differential weathering at the base of the tree. It would show evidence of branches, but there won't be many leaves, because the leaves will have turned into soil. They'd have rotted away. And there shouldn't be any evidence of stuff like blast damage at all. Well, what do we find when we go out and we dig up these fossils? Here am I and our founding director a number of years back in 2018, in Newcastle, Australia. Yes, there's lots and lots of names in Australia that match the ones in England, because of course it was mostly the English immigrants that went out there. But you see, just like Newcastle, England, there's an awful lot of coal from Newcastle, Australia. And there's also a lot of fossil trees. Many of these trees are lying down flat on the ground. Some of them are stumps. And all of the trees point in the same direction, mostly a northeast to southwest direction. And these trees are also so well preserved, we even know what kind of tree they are. Once again, they are those southern conifer trees, the monkey puzzle trees. But as you go along and you walk along the coast, you start to spot some different trees. These trees are not lying flat. These trees are standing up vertically, and they're cutting up through many, many layers of rock. This is a vertical fossil pine tree. You can see it there, and you can see how it goes down into the rock, and at the base of this tree, there is a coal seam. You see the little yellow arrow? Well, what do we find in that coal seam? Fantastic fossil leaves. Fossil leaves that shouldn't be there if this truly was a swamp that's rotting away. But you know what we don't find? We find absolutely no pine needles or soil. Remember, these are pine trees. There's no evidence of any pine needles there. Lots of seed ferns and things like that, but no pine trees. And no soil either. In fact, these trees have got no branches, they have no roots, they've been ripped up, and it's very clear that they've been carried into position. They haven't lived there, died there, and got buried there. So what can we do to do some experiments on this? Well, we can go to our Jurassic Ark in Australia, Polystrate test tank. It's part of our research area and our museums, and you can see what we've got here. We've got a big fish tank. We've filled it up with water. And we're throwing some sticks in. Highly sophisticated stuff. But it does make a really good point, because what we're testing is how sticks and trees behave when they're suspended in water. Because you throw these sticks in and they float. Of course they do. That's what sticks do. But after a little while, some of the sticks begin to tilt. Some of them begin to tilt further. And many of them end up sinking down and falling to the bottom. But a few of them end up standing vertically in the water. In fact, some of them even sit sort of bobbing up and down in the water. What's going on here? Well, it turns out that plants have a brilliantly sophisticated system of being able to suck water from their roots to their leaves. And this system works even when the plant is dead, even when they're sticks. And so the sticks are sitting here and they're sucking water in at one end, and that water is that end is getting heavier. And so that end begins to tip. And as it begins to tip and the water begins to drain back down, it becomes waterlogged at the bottom and the tree will sink vertically. Now it happens as trees, because there's been multiple cases of trees being found bobbing vertically in rivers and stuff and after landslides. It happens with the sticks, but it even happens if they're matchsticks. This was at a big conference a couple of years ago, and we thought we'd give it a try, see what happens. We chucked a load of matchsticks in, and look, most of them are floating. After about 24 hours, some of them begin to hang vertically in the water. Some of them are down on the bottom, lying flat, but a few of them are standing upright. Now, if you were to bury that, what would you find? Well, you'd find a mat of material on the bottom that under a lot of pressure would turn into coal. You'd find a log jam along the top, and you'd find vertical matchsticks, effectively, sitting upright in the rock layers. Well, what do we find in the real world? Exactly that. The trees all start with a coal layer of material that are sunk to the bottom. The vertical trees stand up, and then at the top, you always find a log jam. Ah, the evidence really does show that these trees did not live there, die there, and get buried there. They were ripped up and swept into position by enormous volumes of water. And how much water? Well, let's ask the question, how big are the Carboniferous beds? Carboniferous? Oh yeah, okay, a little bit of history here and a little bit of politics, okay? Because you see, most of these trees are found in the rocks that we call the Carboniferous. Now, we call them the Carboniferous because they're full of carbon. And coal, carbon, was really important for the Industrial Revolution. We needed a lot of it. And so the British basically named most of the geological column, and we called these rocks the Carboniferous rocks. Now, because of our influence across the world, every single country on the planet calls the Carboniferous rocks the Carboniferous rocks, except for one. The one country that doesn't call them Carboniferous rocks is our rebellious cousins over in the United States of America. They actually take the Carboniferous rocks, they split them in two, and they call them the Pennsylvanian and the Mississippian rocks. Right? No prizes to what they're named after. But it's nothing to do with millions of years, it's everything to do with what the rocks are made up of, where they were first studied, and how much you don't like each other. That's basically the history of science right there. But you see, the Carboniferous and the Pennsylvanian are the same rock layers, and you know this because you can trace the Pennsylvanian all the way up from Tennessee, up through Pennsylvania, and if you cross over the border into Canada, where they're still loyal to us Brits, they call them Carboniferous rocks. So how big are these Carboniferous rocks? What's the extent of them? How big is this flood that produced all these polystrate trees? Well, Professor Derek Ager made this point. The Carboniferous, he says, extends in essentially the same form from Texas to the Dantes coal basin north of the Caspian Sea in the USSR. Slightly dated reference, but of course you've probably heard a thing or two about the Dantes region recently with all the politics that's going on between Ukraine and Russia. But you see, he said, this amounts to some 170 degrees of longitude, and closing up the Atlantic by a mere 40 degrees does not really help at all that much in explaining the remarkable phenomena. There's Texas, there's the Caspian Sea. The Carboniferous flood deposits go across the world. What's even more remarkable is that they've even turned up on the west coast of Australia in the last few years. You see, these flood deposits truly are worldwide. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. In fact, we're going to finish with one brief but final example. We're not going to go across the world and compare. We're going to use one single deposit to show that there must have been a worldwide flood. In fact, it's not just a single deposit, it's one single log jam. Where are we? Well, we're going to go to Australia. I was here just 3 weeks ago. We're going to go to our outdoor museum, Jurassic Ark, near Gympie. People come along and visit. They get to see the dinosaurs, and they get to dig up fossils. Dig up fossils? Yeah, we actually started this museum because of the dig site there. We've been excavating for nearly 20 years. And the kind of fossils we find there are fossil trees. And these fossil trees have got no branches. These fossil trees have got no roots. And these fossil trees are buried with boulders. And all of this is starting to piece together a big piece of evidence. And in fact, it's not just that. We also find polystrate trees. There's the rock layers, there's the tree. This tree is cutting up through many rock layers, which means, by the way, that the rock layers, the strata, had to be deposited in less time than it takes a pine tree to rot. Here's one giant tree. Come down to the base of it. What do you see? The tree roots are torn off. And if you go up to the top of the tree, it's buried next to a boulder. And some of these boulders are very big indeed, up to half a meter across. Now, boulders buried next to trees make a really important point. Because you see, logs float, rocks don't. So if you want to find a big boulder next to a tree, the water has to be traveling fast enough to actually bring those two things and carry them along at the same time. So don't be surprised that we've called this a fossil flood logjam. Logjam? Yeah, well, you can go around the world today and you can see evidence of log jams. Here's one up in Canada, a giant landslide that has come down and poured all of these logs and trees into the water. Their tree roots have been torn off, their branches have been stripped, and look what happens as they bash and crash into each other. The ends begin to get abraded. They get pointy. In fact, our fossil trees show exactly the same abrasion. There's the fossil one on the left. There's the modern day landslide one on the right. We are really dealing with a flood dump. Oh, and by the way, these trees are also, you guessed it, southern conifer trees. Supposedly 200 million years worth of evolution, and there's no evidence of it. And all of these logs are pointing in the same direction, from a southwest to northeast direction, all across the deposits. Okay, so what have we seen in this one fossil flood log jam? Well, they're oriented, they're all pointing in the same direction. They're broken, they've been ripped up and torn and stripped. They've been abraded at the ends. It's a mixed dump because we've found shells mixed up in here as well, giant rocks. All of this shows evidence that they have been deposited by a flood. So how big is this log jam? Oh, not the Jurassic rocks. Because the Jurassic rocks go across the planet. How big is this single log jam? Well, there it is in Australia. A single log jam. Now, just to put a little bit of perspective in there, there's the UK next to Australia. There's the log jam next to the UK and Australia. That's a pretty big log jam. Now think about this. For every cubic meter of sandstone is what these logs are buried in. For every cubic meter of sandstone means that you need around 3 cubic meters of other rocks, mostly granite type rocks, to be eroded and destroyed in order to make enough sand to actually bury these trees. In other words, you need 3 times the amount of that rock to be eroded away by water in order to produce the sediment that you have here. You see, just for this single log jam in Australia requires a flood of global proportions to both erode the sediment, to flood over the land, to rip up the trees, and to bury them as rocks in a huge slurry of sediment. The evidence of Noah's flood really is very strong. But of course, if any of you are studying geology, I wouldn't recommend making your next university thesis on the value of Noah's flood in modelling sedimentary deposits in Earth's history. It won't go very well. I wonder why. Well, the reason is this. The science teacher, 2003. Scientific theories are therefore explanations about aspects of nature without reference to God. Now, go back a few hundred years and you had Kepler, Johann Kepler, who revolutionized our view of planetary motion. He said science is thinking God's thoughts after him. I think that's one of the best definitions of science. God did it, we try and work out what he did. So how did we go from science being thinking God's thoughts after him to scientific theories having no reference to God whatsoever? Well, one of the big influences in this is a man by the name of Charles Lyell. There he is, his picture in the Natural History Museum in London a few years back, with his catchphrase, "The present is the key to the past." In other words, what he promoted was a principle called uniformitarianism, the steadiness of what we see today has always been in play. In other words, if we see a tiny little gully with a river in it, which is very slowly eroding away that gully, boy, must it have taken millions of years to erode the Grand Canyon. That was his logic. But why did he promote this? Why did he push this idea of uniformitarianism? Well, by his own admission, his aim in promoting millions of years and evolution was to free science from Moses. Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, one of the Psalms, Psalm 19. You realize if you get rid of the first five books of the Bible, the rest of Christianity comes falling down? Because if you get rid of a creation, you get rid of a God who has a say over his creation. You get rid of a God who only can create. You also get rid of, by the way, of a world that was very good. And you get rid of a God who has a say over mankind. You also get rid of mankind being made in God's own image, which means mankind is no different from the animals. And if you're no different from the animals, guess what? I can treat you like one. That's the logic. If you get rid of the fall of mankind, as found in Genesis chapter 3, then you get rid of the answer to why would a good God let bad things happen? The answer is he didn't. It's our fault. We messed up. You also, by the way, get rid of a God who does actually make sure that there are consequences for sin, because he does indeed judge. You also get rid of the origin of sin and death, making Christ's sacrifice pointless. If you get rid of the global flood, as found in Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9, not only do you get rid of a huge amount of geological history that we see on the earth around us today, but you also get rid of a God who can judge, a God who has the right to judge, a God who has judged in the past, has promised he'll judge again in the future, and a God like that might have the odd rule we ought to be following. If you get rid of the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, then you get rid of the true history of mankind, which means that you're left with the very racist ideology which Charles Darwin and Charles Lyell promoted, which is if you have a darker skin colour than a white Englishman, then you must be less evolved. Pretty horrible, nasty stuff, but stuff that they actually argued for because of deep time and evolution. In fact, we have a great big library in our museum, and there's a horrendous book which I can't even give you the title of, but it's basically arguing that dark-skinned people, African ethnic origin people, are no longer can be considered made in God's image. Therefore, there's no point sending missionaries, because they can't be saved. Pretty horrible, nasty, vile stuff, but stuff that is the direct consequence of accepting millions of years and evolution. If you get rid of the law of God, by the way, you have no basis for morality whatsoever. So you can live however you want. But you do have to realize it's not the evidence that disagrees with the biblical record of creation and Noah's flood over the last 6,000 to 7,000 years, but it's the opinions of mankind who willfully set out to reject and to replace the word of God. Ah, that was read earlier today, wasn't it? John read that up here. We are told to beware of the scoffers that come who will reject both creation and Noah's flood. So be ready to actually give an answer for the hope that is within you. How do you do that? Well, you start by taking off Darwin's glasses. Take off Charles Darwin's glasses and start seeing things God's way. We're going to finish today where we finished last night. Philippians chapter 2, verse 5. Let this mind be in you that was also in Christ Jesus. Well, thank you very much for listening. I know there's a lot of information, but a reminder, creationresearch.net is the place to go. And if you want to follow me and the work that I do around the planet, then I'd encourage you either find me on Facebook, Instagram, sign up to the newsletter, or follow me on Telegram. That's Telegram, the social media app, not beep, beep, beep. But you can actually follow where I am and what I'm doing across the planet. Thank you very much.